Mr. Fleischer.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kerry Fleischer on behalf of the plaintiff, Auditech. We're here on the denial of the preliminary injunction. The reason the court denied the preliminary injunction is the court found that there was no fiduciary relationship. The contract that's contained in our appendix to our brief says it's not a simple supply contract. The words joint venture and partnership are important words because they describe situations where there's a fiduciary duty. If there's a fiduciary duty, it's a fiduciary duty of loyalty and candor. In this case, the parties intended a partnership-like relationship. How do I know? Because the contract says it did. It points out the intent of the parties and says we do in the covenant in 1.1, we do not want just a legal relationship. We want something more than that. We want a deeper sense of commitment to the long-term success of all partners. When parties say we want a deeper commitment to the long-term success of all partners, that's basically a definition of what fiduciary responsibility is all about. When two parties enter into a contract and they want to benefit each other rather than just themselves, that's fiduciary responsibility. It's expressed in the agreement, and we gave a number of exhibits in the record where the parties referred to themselves as partners, referred to the fact that they want something more than a legal responsibility. And in ADC Exhibit 15, written by Peter Jackson, a managerial employee of ADC, he says, our intention was not just to enter into a contractual vendor-supplier relationship, but to enter into a covenant committed to the long-term success of both parties. That's mutual benefit, that's fiduciary duty. If the court views that there's a fiduciary duty between the parties because there's joint venture, then in this case we have ADC conceitedly not disclosing during the 2.5 years of the contract the fact that they were developing a product on the side without telling Auditech about it. In the brief of ADC, they point out that Mr. Homan, who signed letters very directly, never told Auditech about the Seymour, and they say in their brief that the reason why he didn't disclose it was because it's not Auditech's concern. It's impossible for this court to believe that Auditech had no concern regarding the fact that their marketer was developing its own product in order to compete with Auditech at the time that Auditech had turned over all its customers to the marketer, Automation Direct, allowed Automation Direct all the contact with the customers, and that Auditech during this period of time had no knowledge of the conflict of interest that was going on during this period of time. The briefs, both briefs, our brief obviously talks about trust. Even Automation Direct in their brief says that Mr. Homan believes that Auditech breached its trust, did not do what they were supposed to do because he trusted us. Everybody agreed in this case that there was a trust-like fiduciary relationship. And there was a breach of that fiduciary relationship because nothing was disclosed to us regarding what they were going to do. The court did agree, the district court, that we showed substantial evidence of joint venture, but says that this one clause, 1.6, negates a partnership or joint venture. If the parties have a clause in their agreement that says that we don't want you to enter into contracts in the name of the other, we don't want you to bind the other, that clause means that you don't have a partnership or joint venture. There's no case law to support that. There's no case law cited to support that. In fact, the Illinois Partnership Act and many cases we cited specifically provide that partners have a right and a joint ventures have a right to provide that a partner can do nothing, for example. A partner can't sign checks. A partner can't bind the other party. A partner can't do various acts. Again and again in the Partnership Act that we cited, it says partners can bind each other unless the agreement provides otherwise. In our agreement, because of the fact that the parties knew they were entering into a joint venture, called themselves partners, because of that, the parties included a clause that when ADC, Automation Direct, would go in advertising and contract for advertising, they would contract in their own name, and when Auditech would contract for supplies, they would contract in their own name. However, payments came out of a joint account. the joint account that we've cited to the court in the appendix, which is attached to the contract, calls for dividends. A simple supply agreement does not call for dividends. The attachment provides that ADC, Automation Direct, was going to receive dividends from the joint account. Payments were going to come from the joint account. For both parties, we're going to get paid out of the joint account and then receive dividends. That's a sharing of profit and loss. We have here the...
Well, of profit, anyway.
That's a sharing of profit, correct? And there's even provisions in there that say that if Auditech had losses, I believe it's 2.6 of the contract provides that if Auditech has losses in connection with supply agreements, they can charge the joint account for those losses, and thus Automation Direct is paying half of that. We've got the express agreement. We've got a manifestation of intent to be associated with the joint ventures. We've got a contribution of property. Everybody contributed $150,000 each to this, plus effort, skill. Joint rights of control, they couldn't price their goods without our consent. That was specifically provided in the agreement that because the profits are going into a joint account, before they sell it to a customer, they need our approval. On the other hand, the price that we charge to them was also provided in the agreement as based upon just we're getting our material costs paid, and it's provided in there exactly how the costs are being charged. Everything was joint control. We pointed out the court team captains that would decide various things. We have exhibit after exhibit stating we'd like to sell and develop this product, and there was discussions where it was vetoed during a period of time that we didn't know that they were developing their own product in order to continue on. A provision for joint sharing and profits and losses I've already discussed. All of these things show that we have a joint venture in this case. I quoted two Seventh Circuit cases that said that where you have where you've shown that there's a competition between the parties and there's a loss because of competition between the parties, that that's enough to get a preliminary injunction, that show there's a presumption of irreparable injury, and thus we are entitled to a preliminary injunction for that. This whole concept of fiduciary duty is a concept that the law has established in order to say that in certain circumstances you have to look out for the other party. And the courts have said in a partnership joint venture in Illinois and closely held corporations, there's a fiduciary duty because in those cases you have obligations to each other, not just the almighty wallet. There's also special circumstances where there's a fiduciary duty established. The Illinois courts in Illinois Rockford versus Culp, which I cited, which is an Illinois Supreme Court case, says we don't know exactly where the grounds of fiduciary duty are. We have to look at each case to see. This is a case where the parties clearly agreed that they were going to look out for each other. They had covenants that said we together are going to capture a certain amount of the market. That's a case where there's a fiduciary duty. Even if it's not a joint venture, it's a fiduciary duty. Once we show a fiduciary duty, there can be no question that there's a breach because they agreed that from the middle of 2002 onwards until the middle of 2004, they were developing their own product. Even when they sent out a letter of termination, they didn't tell us it was being developed by their owner, Coyo. They led us to believe it was being developed by a third party. But nevertheless, for 2 years, they're getting money out of a joint account in order to woo customers with the intention those customers eventually are going to be theirs and not Auditech's. Auditech's investing money so that ADC can go out and sell to customers, develop a customer base for the benefit of both parties, while ADC is doing it for their own benefit. At the end of the day, what happened, as we pointed out in our sworn pleadings, and the only sworn pleadings here were by us, none by Automation Direct, we didn't even have the customer names. We don't even know who the customers were except for some warranty claims. All those were in the province of Automation Direct, who kept that information from Auditech so that when the Seymour came out, they could develop and sell that product to them and leave Auditech with a product that had been developed according to the relationship, but with no one to sell it to, or at least to go into competition with one arm tied behind our back. There's comments that have been made in the briefs by Automation Direct with cases that say ordinarily parties should guard their own interest. In certain cases, both parties have the obligation of candor and loyalty that is present in certain relationships. It's impossible to say that in this relationship that the parties envisioned that when Automation Direct was selling these products, that unbeknownst to Auditech, that they were selling these products with the intent of taking these customers for themselves. Parties have to look at what the intent of the party, I'm sorry, the court has to look at what the intent of the parties is when construing whether there's a joint venture. There's no possible argument that the intent of the parties was that when we were sitting down with meetings with Automation Direct discussing future plans, that it was okay if Automation Direct's secret future plans were to take the customer base for themselves. We believe that we're entitled to a preliminary injunction, and it doesn't even have to be sent back for trial because...
Well, it would have to be because the defense has had no opportunity to present its case, that the balance of harms would augur in their favor, and all the other defenses to preliminary injunction that they've not had an opportunity to raise.
The only reason that you could just grant their preliminary injunction is because we had filed verified pleadings. Once there's verified pleadings, those pleadings must be taken as true. Unless defendant files verified pleadings, there's no need for an evidentiary hearing. There's only I cited case law in our briefs that says you don't get an evidentiary hearing unless there's verified pleadings. Since they didn't file
verified pleadings are completely alien to federal practice. They're not provided for by the rules. They have the status of an affidavit, we have held, but affidavits just set the stage for evidentiary hearings. They're not a reason to avoid evidentiary hearings.
I believe that the law on preliminary injunctions is that the court does not have, the defendant in a case does not have a right to an evidentiary hearing on a preliminary injunction. Unless
that's temporary restraining order you're talking about, but go ahead.
Actually, I understand a temporary restraining order is different, but I'm saying even on a preliminary injunction, I cited cases. Well, that's what Judge Holderman held. I will admit Judge Holderman said exactly what you're shaking your head and stating, Judge Easterbrook, that even though they had not filed anything verified to contest our statements, that they're still entitled to an evidentiary hearing. We believe that since case law says that they hadn't contested those facts, that they weren't entitled to an evidentiary hearing. That's my case. Any questions? I will hold additional time for rebuttal, please.
Ms. Lisher.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, my name is Nancy Lisher, and I represent the defendants appellees, AutomationDirect.com, or ADC, and Mr. Tim Homan. I would first remind this court, this is before it, under an abuse of discretion standard of review, and the district court did not abuse its discretion in holding that the plaintiff failed to meet its burden at the end of its case, that an extraordinary preliminary relief was warranted. Your Honor, I would like to just supplement and correct some of plaintiff's facts. This contract was filed by non-lawyers, by two gentlemen who shared, at the time, a personal friendship and a personal interest or a joint interest in religions. Yes, this was supposed to be more than just a manufacturer marketing contract, but only to the extent that they had a really big goal. They wanted to take on 25% of the market. There was reference to a memo talking about this was going to be more than a usual contract, but again, Your Honors, these were experienced businessmen, although drafting inartful contracts, and they did have a clause at the end saying that this written document is the entire agreement of the parties. It says any prior discussions were superseded, and it also said no modifications unless in writing. Your Honors, it's very clear if you look at Part 4 that ADC's role was to be a marketer. It's very clear under Part 5 that the plaintiff was just a manufacturer of these products. Yes, it's true that ADC designated what it wanted for a product, and that was part of the contract. But this is akin to Sears Roebuck buying a Whirlpool washing machine, and Sears says, I want this in my washing machine. Then they rebrand it, and they sell it. In terms of the customer lists, I would like to point out to the court that the parties understood that they were supposed to, they wrote in, ADC had to give customer lists, i.e. names and addresses, all 277 of them, and that was the testimony, contrary to the verified complaint, that it was 5,000 names. But the contract was very clear that the reverse obligation did not exist. There was a reference that ADC was supposed to provide customer information, but Defendant's Exhibit 45 is typical of what was provided every single month, although, again, we didn't have a chance to put on our case. But every month we provided information. Was it a first-time buyer? Was it a pre-existing ADC buyer? What did they pay for the model? What was the model number, the quantity, the date, et cetera? So that's the kind of information that, in fact, was required under the contract and provided. I'd like to address the mutual control requirement, which is, in Illinois, the most important requirement. The district court did not abuse its discretion in making the finding, based on the evidence before him, that these parties did not have an ability to bind or control each other, and there was a provision, Section 1.6, in that contract. This court's decision in Trustmark explains why that provision prevented the creation of either, well, a joint venture or a partnership, since we're hearing both concepts. If there's no ability to have mutual control, if one person cannot act for this so-called separate entity, this so-called joint venture, then there's no way to move forward for the enterprise or move forward to accomplish that object of the joint venture. And this is exactly the distinction this court made in the Trustmark case. I'd also like to address this joint investment account. I actually went back to the beginning and said, okay, now what is a profit? What a profit is that if you have this entity, here they're claiming a joint venture, there has to be something that's considered to be gross proceeds. You subtract from that the cost or expenses of a business, and then you're going to have net proceeds or profits. I'm getting this from Blacks, which I didn't cite, I'm sorry, in my brief, but it's very clear if you look at this joint account that it was not a sharing of profits. Although, having said that, I would like to point out that the judge found against us on this point, and we do disagree. What this was a restricted fund. It had a primary purpose of having funds available for what? Advertising and product development. This clearly was not a checking account or a vehicle of the joint venture, as they've argued. And I would point out to this court, Defendant Exhibit 24, and I think this is important because Mr. Kumar actually proposed to continue under the contract by eliminating the joint account, which by then was something of an issue between the two parties. Your Honors, we've briefed thoroughly the fiduciary obligation. I don't think you can just go in and claim, well, I trusted him, and therefore I have a right to sue him. This isn't what contracts are all about, and this isn't what businesses are all about. There was a finding that this was an experienced businessman. He was on the president's leadership council. He can't just walk in and say, oh, well, here, take over everything, as he now claims he did. But there's been, you know, the denial of a preliminary injunction was based on two things, not just the fact that there's no mutual control, but also because there was no evidence of breach. The trial court did not abuse it. He did properly apply the Doebert test. He did not abuse his discretion by saying, if you don't examine the product, you cannot say that confidential materials were used simply by reading advertising, and that's what he did. The other thing he found was that the plaintiff had never proven that there was anything used. The underlying, let me back up. Mr. Martin said, look, the reason I think that they use confidential information is because there's a similarity in the appearance of the screen. And two is, he thought it would be very difficult to create this brand new technology of point-and-click conversion, which is what Seymour had developed. Martin testified, I have no experience in this. I've never tried it. I think it would not be simple. It would be daunting. It would be complex. It would be a technical challenge. But it's possible. He said, oh, yeah, you can do this by trial and error. And, in fact, that's exactly how my client did it, although, again, I didn't have a chance to put on my case. The bottom line for this purported expert was, well, there was no precedent for it. Well, to say that something cannot be done because there's no precedent would mean we wouldn't have BlackBerries or computers. When Kennedy said in 1962, we're going to the moon this decade, the technology wasn't there.
According to at least one show on ABC, we didn't go to the moon.
Well, in any event, I can tell you that even this limited record shows that ADC is exactly the type of company that says relative competitive advantage. We want to push where other people haven't gone. We want to do customer-driven leadership, and we're the kind of company that wants to do and accomplish things that have never been tried. One last thing, and I know that we've argued this in our brief, but the plaintiff can't have it always. He argues that we breached the contract for developing a new product during the lifetime of this contract, but the plaintiff did that twice. Once with Squared, and it used our GUI technology, and the second time with the EasyView, which it launched the day after this contract terminated. Again, plaintiff can't have it always. You can't complain it's unfair that ADC developed Seymour and intended to convert customers because that's exactly what the plaintiff did, not once, but twice. Seymour did develop and wants to attract new customers, but it developed its own software source code, and it did not have access to the product schematics of EasyTouch. And I would like to just point out, Your Honors, trying to attract other companies' customers is what competition is all about. That's what everybody does, including the plaintiff. The plaintiff complains that we kept secrets, but, of course, they did that too. They secretly started to sell the Squared products. They took out ads without telling us, and they secretly developed EasyView. Although the plaintiff uses joint venture, partnership, fiduciary duty, claims foul, he thinks that the plaintiff thinks this is a one-way street, that only ADC owes these obligations and that it owes nothing.
Counsel, let me tell you what worried me when I looked at this. This contract plainly has clauses that allow the parties to collaborate in setting price. Now, the usual term for that in antitrust law is resale price maintenance. Resale price maintenance is unlawful per se under the antitrust laws unless there is a joint venture. A joint venture can engage in resale price maintenance. Does it not follow from that that this must be a joint venture? Because the alternative is that both sides have committed a federal felony.
Your Honor, I'd be happy to address that afterwards. I'm not prepared today to discuss antitrust law because it's neither been briefed,
well,
and I can't really answer it. But can I answer the setting price?
I understand that it hasn't been raised by your adversary, and maybe I should have asked Mr. Fleischer whether the two of you submitted this joint venture, since it's his view that this is a joint venture, whether the two of you submitted this to the antitrust division for clearance.
Well,
together the answer is no.
Here's the thing, Your Honor, as I understand it, and again, not in the record because we didn't put on our case, there was this complicated formula where they were supposed to charge us for per unit. But the truth is that we just bought the units right off of Priceless. That's how we got them. So there was no formula here that would trigger these kinds of profit things. And it is my understanding that the contract, if I recall the contract, it indicates something along the lines of ADC will decide the price, and then there's this sort of PS, well, yeah, we'll talk to Autotech, except it's my understanding that never happened. Just like the cost to us when Autotech sold us the units, it wasn't done on a formula, and it's my understanding that non-lawyers wrote this contract, and what you're saying, in fact, did not happen. So contract aside, it's not. But again, as Judge Evans said, we didn't have a chance to put on our price. Would you like me to submit briefing on this issue after the fact?
If that's necessary, we'll let you know.
Okay. For these reasons and the reasons stated in my brief, Your Honors, I would ask this court to affirm. I would just like to pose that if this court rules that this kind of contract gives rise to a fiduciary duty, it would change all business relationships. It would impose duties of care that the parties haven't bargained for. It would rewrite a contract to include a non-competition clause that takes effect after termination when one was not in here. And it would also rewrite the contract to prohibit development of new products. And again, my client developed a new product completely independent. If this court ruled against these, we want to promote public policy for competition, and we want to promote the public policy in developing new products. But
I don't think you want to be trumpeting the public policy in competition when this agreement is a per se violation of the antitrust laws.
Your Honor, I cannot concede that. I'm sorry, and I will be happy to address it in writing. For the reasons stated in my brief and today, I would ask this court to affirm the trial court did not abuse its discretion. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Fleischer?
Comments. First of all, in answer to your question, we do believe this is a joint venture. We do believe that it
Was it submitted to the Antitrust Division for their review?
It was not submitted, is my understanding.
Were federal income taxes paid on the profits of this joint venture?
They were, Your Honor. They were paid by each party.
No. One files a joint venture tax return. Was a tax return ever filed?
I think a partnership. One files a partnership tax return.
A partnership tax return showing these two as the partners in a joint venture. Was that ever filed?
There was no partnership tax return filed. Right. It was as a joint venture.
So all of the normal legal attributes of a joint venture were ignored. It doesn't have a name. It didn't file a tax return. Wasn't submitted to the antitrust division.
I am not aware of a rule that says that if the two parties have a joint venture, it must be submitted to the antitrust division. And secondly,
normally you don't have to do it unless the joint venture is going to do something that would otherwise be a felony.
No, but there are many cases where in every partnership case, two parties have agreed to price regulation. And if they agree to price restrictions, it would be a violation if they weren't partners. But I don't believe that I've ever seen any law that says that all partnerships that have provisions regarding what they're going to do regarding price have to submit that to the antitrust. Just like in franchising, it doesn't have to be submitted to the antitrust. But beyond that, I also understand that under the tax laws, partnerships have to be submit, there has to be a partnership tax return.
And you agree that none was ever filed?
No partnership tax return, but I'm unaware of a rule that says that if two parties have a joint venture, that they, on a joint venture, that they have to submit a partnership tax return. As to the comments about non-lawyers, I would like to respond that the comment that because non-lawyers drafted it, it should be the party's intention should not be garnered from the document. I actually think it's the opposite, that because non-lawyers drafted it and said that we intend to have something other than a normal vendor-supply relationship, that should be given great importance because of the fact that the non-lawyers have drafted it. As to the joint account, we're just looking at two different agreements, I guess, because the joint investment account provides that in 6.2 says that ADC is not liable for non-dispersed expenses if the account has a zero or negative balance. Likewise, Auditech is not liable for non-dispersed expenses if it has a zero or negative balance. Otherwise, the joint account pays. 6.3 says that if Auditech suffers supply damages because of long-term contracts, the joint account will compensate Auditech for the losses. As to pricing, counsel said that there's no clause in here regarding the price we charge to them, but the price is specifically provided by the parties in 2.4 that says that Auditech will invoice Automation Direct at 1.9 times our material cost. And it specifically stated that that will be the price during the first 18 months of the contract. It's also specifically stated that when ADC sells the product, they only keep a certain amount of that, and the rest goes to the joint account, which is the distribution of profits between the parties. As to the comments regarding mutual control, we've stated in here that almost everything is subject to mutual control in this agreement, from pricing to development of products to everything. As to breach of contract, I can only state that if there's a fiduciary duty and if they did not disclose the fact they were developing this competitive product during the period of time, that's a breach of fiduciary duty. It has nothing to do with impacting people all over the world and everything. It has to do when two parties say, I'm going to market your products and use best efforts and do these things, and then during the period of time you're hiding from the other side that you're developing your own product.
Well, let me ask you, why wouldn't damages be an appropriate remedy here if you're right?
Because there's an entire customer base that's worth a certain amount of money. There's a company, there's an entity that's worth a certain amount of money. When now that we're competing with each other, anytime you have competition issues, the reason why Illinois law and the federal law says that it's presumed that you have, that when you have competition between parties is you get injunctive relief, because it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to state how much, what would this venture have been worth? What would we have benefited from? How much would we have made in the next few years? The better answer is that if somebody is wrongfully competing, just stop. Just stop. And that's why when you have restrictive covenants, when you have breach of fiduciary duty for competition, I believe the law says that you're not going to make parties go in and say, well, what is our loss? How much did we lose? What would have happened if they had really carried out their obligations? Just stop competing. Just don't produce this product that you did in violation. So that's the reason. I have nothing further.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.